Before we begin today's show, I wanted to remind you to check out The Low Post with Zach Lowe. Twice a week, Zach gives his unique analytical take on the NBA with an assortment of regular guests. Last week, he spoke to Brian Scalabrine about the now 500 Celtics and did a draft of All-Stars with Kevin Pelton. You can find The Low Post wherever you get your podcasts. Hello and welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. We talk about the NBA, which we're doing on Monday afternoon as a little editor's note. I don't edit this. It's a host's note. It's March 1st. Welcome to March, etc. Effective immediately, pods will be coming out on Tuesdays and Fridays. So make a note. Either let it be written, let it be said. Joining us from Austin, Texas, where the ice is melted. His Wi-Fi isn't working very well, but Kurt Goldsberry is with us.
What is up, Brian? It is great to be with you today.
And join us from Oklahoma City, where they got ice, but I think the power stayed on, is Royce Young.
Yep. Officially thawed out here in OKC, and I think spring has sprung, sort of. So
famous last words. We don't say that in the Midwest.
Oh, sorry.
We know it's just a cruel joke. It's a cruel joke. Spring has sprung in the New York City area because the New York Knicks, after a good weekend, are a game above 500 and 18-17. Headed down your way, though, for a Texas road trip, Kirk. So we'll see if they're able to maintain it. But let me just say at the start of this season, things I did not expect, which would be that we would be leading a podcast with the Knicks in March, where it wasn't like some sort of trade or some sort of embarrassment, quite frankly. And, you know, I don't know if I want to say they're the story of the league because, you know, Utah and Brooklyn for sure, but they are one of the stories of this season. They're in fourth place. As we're talking right now, they're in fourth place. Now it's really bunched in the East. So the Knicks are 18-17, and between the fourth place Knicks and the, what is this, the 10th place Bulls, we're talking about a game and a half. And then, you know, four and a half to get all the way back to like 13th. So the Knicks have a bad week or a bad road trip. You know, it won't look so rosy. But at this moment in time, let's just take our hats off to them, because this is a team that I thought was going to be competing for the worst record in the East this year, which I didn't think was a bad thing. They specifically saved their salary cap space because they couldn't get the free agents they wanted to. But yet here they are, lowest payroll in the league, which is amazing to say about the Knicks, and the second best defense in the league in a year where we are seeing crazy offense, the craziest offensive season in league history. And I have some stats from Sports and Information about the month of February that I'm going to go over right here, because I talked about this in the podcast a few weeks ago, guys, but I want to update this. So there were 7 30-point per game scorers and 19 25 per point per game scorers in February, the most in NBA history. The previous record for 30-point scorers in a month was 6. So, and then the previous record for 25-point scorers was 15. There were an average of 225.6 points per game scored in the 212 games in the month. And it was a longer month of February than normal, because usually the All-Star break happens in there. So you have to look at averages, not totals. So third highest points per game average in a calendar month in league history, dating all the way back to February of last year. How about that? Zion Williamson averaged 20 points per game in the paint in the month of February. It's the most since Shaq in March of 2003, when he averaged 22 points a game. Joel Embiid became the first 76ers player to average 30 points and 10 rebounds in a month since, you guys want to take a guess?
The Chuckster or Moses.
That's not Chuck, but Moses would have been a good guess. Chuck, in December of 1990, Charles Barkley, December 1990, Zach LaVine was the first Bulls player to average 30 points in a month since.
Oh, Royce, you got to get that one, buddy.
I don't want to say the obvious. I'm going to say Derrick Rose, though.
No, it's a decent guess. Joakim Noah. No, just kidding. Michael Jordan, 1998.
See, I felt like that was way too obvious, so I went with Rosen.
I'm just pointing out that Zach LaVine just had a Jordan month, is what I'm saying, okay? And so all this is to say that the Knicks have gone from the 23rd defense in the league to the second-ranked defense in the league, and that, Kirk, is why they are over 500 and playing well. And I think we should acknowledge it at this point in the game.
Yeah, let me start by saying it's great. And anybody who's been to Madison Square Garden for a playoff game knows that it's great. The fact that the Knicks could be back in the playoffs at some point consistently is good for the NBA at large. And Tom Thibodeau's done a great job. And as you said, they're doing it with defense. And Leon Rose is doing a good job essentially setting up the narrative that they're a competent franchise open for business potentially in the offseason. And I want the Knicks to be back so bad, Brian. The fact that they are currently in fourth place and they might be a playoff team makes me happy. But let me be Debbie Downer for a minute.
Please, look what we brought you here.
I think it might be a mirage. I think they might be fake good. I'm worried the numbers suggest this isn't real. Let me explain that. You mentioned these crazy offensive numbers. You know, there's something called three-point mania happening in the NBA. We know this. An average jump shot in the NBA for the first time in league history is now worth over a point. 10 years ago, it was worth about 0.84 points. So it's crazy. But let me explain.
Roughly, guys are shooting. It's improved by 15%.
Yeah, and it's because of the three-point to mid-range ratio, which we all know is changing and how. I don't want to get into that, but I want to contextualize the Knicks' defensive performance with that in mind. Knicks opponents currently, Brian, have the worst three-point shooting luck in the NBA. Not only are they only making 32% of their threes, which is the lowest, their shot quality suggests that number should be higher. And not only that, Knicks opponents are making just 29% of their uncontested threes, which is by far the lowest such mark in the NBA. For context, the best defense in the NBA is the Lakers. Their opponents are making 45% of those uncontested threes. So the shooting gods have been smiling down on the Knicks, pumping up those defensive efficiency numbers. But those numbers suggest that their luck might run out. They got a string of hard opponents coming up. And like you said, the bunched up thing, I think, is the key. Right now they're in fourth, but they're two games away from being in 10th. And, you know, the way this is going, if their three-point luck runs out, if they hit a tough stretch, they could be right back out of the playoffs. So I want them to be good, and I thought I was going to be Debbie Downer. But there are some warning signs here, guys, that this might not be sustainable right now.
Kirk, did you not see the video that was on the internet the other night after the Knicks won of fans literally celebrating? Like, how dare you?
I told you I was going to be Debbie Downer, Royce.
Here's the thing, though, and you touched on it, that I think that may be more important than just the fact that they are currently in fourth and that they're above 500 for the first time in many years. But you mentioned it, Kirk. They look competent. They look like a true, well-run organization right now. And that starts from – it's finally – you're getting like that linear trickle-down of front office looks good, coaching staff looks good, team looks good. And like that's how an organization's supposed to function. But, you know, whether it's three-point luck, I think maybe I would reclassify that as the Tibbs fear factor. I'm just going to say opponents are intimidated by Tibbs and the menace of the Knicks defense that they just can't shoot right. That's how I'm going to choose to believe it. Because I want the Knicks to be good too, because it makes basketball better. It makes conversation around the game better. It makes the Eastern Conference more compelling. And it's not just like this big market, like infatuation we all have, but like the Knicks, even though we call them a storied franchise, there's not much storied about them in reality, but like there's a prestige there, and it's just better for just the league itself and for everybody that covers it when one of your prestige franchises is good. So how dare you poo-poo?
I have such good memories in the NBA on NBC in the 90s, Sunday afternoon games at the Garden when you know, John Starks and Patrick Ewing, Allen Houston were going, and you know, they'd be playing Miami or Chicago, and Marv Albert and Mike Fratello, the czar of the Telestrator, working it. I have this vivid memory of this this Christmas, maybe it was even Christmas Day, but Christmas time game I'm watching, you know, Sunday afternoon, and they come back out of break And there's a dog outside. There's a man with a dog outside Madison Square Garden, and the dog has a Santa cap on, and there's an unlit cigarette in the dog's mouth. You know, just a funny New York thing was going on, and it's quiet. You know, and they come back inside, and they're showing it, and you hear the organ going, and Marv goes, "Always sad when a dog smokes." I just have this memory.
That's been the Knicks motto for the last 20 years, Brian.
So they play this. I mentioned they're coming down to Kirk's Way. They're playing the Spurs on Tuesday night, and then they close the first half with the Pistons at home. That's a winnable game. But this is what Kirk is talking about coming out in the second half. They open the second half with the Bucks, and they go see Royce in Oklahoma City. And then it's Nets, 76ers, Magic, 76ers. So right there, just in the next eight games, they have Spurs, Bucks, Nets, 76ers twice. So they're going to get a real test to it. And, you know, you say that they're well run. I agree that their franchise, I think they're showing moderation.
I didn't like the Derrick Rose trade personally, but I mean.
Well, I'll ask Kirk about that in a second. But they left their salary cap space unspent. Largely because they didn't know what to spend it on. And the biggest story about them this year is the emergence of Julius Randle, who has become an all-star, an unusual jump in his career. He was a guy that could score at times, but absolutely would kill you at the defensive end. And, you know, he had, you know, when he was in New Orleans, he had moments, but he just couldn't be trusted at the defensive end. They had to let him go. He's on his third team in like 6 years. And he has become more of a point forward, distributing the ball, playing so much better on defense, you know, taking higher percentage shots. But Leon Rose drafted his replacement in Obi Toppin. You know, I don't think Leon came in and looked at the lay of the land and was like, Julius Randle is a hidden gem. And I don't think Tom Thibodeau was like, oh, we can, let me polish this guy up. I think they just, a confluence of events allowed Julius Randle to emerge. And it's been a great story. And you know, to have an unexpected all-star is really surprising, especially a guy, you know, sort of that well into his career. I mean, he's in the middle of his career pretty much. And to see this elevation is kind of surprising. So I don't think they thought they would have this team. I think they thought they would have a team that would be better, but would be in the lottery. And that's probably where they're going to end up, Kirk. But I just looked it up. They've got the third hardest schedule in the East left. And they have a 6-game road trip. They still have to do a West Coast trip, a 6-game road trip in May. It's the first time I've ever used those words, in May. So like they have sort of that looming on the back end of their schedule.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't want to sound like Debbie Downer, so I'll flip it around, because I think the goal for this season was to establish some sort of competent culture in New York. And the road from bad to good has to pass through mediocre or average on the way. And it looks like that's where they are. And I don't want to take a snapshot right now on March 1st and say, well, they were in fourth place on March 1st. And then because of the strength of schedule sort of quirk, they fall a few games back. Now they're out of the playoffs. And we look at that as a failure. That would be really dangerous if the narrative starts to look at the Knicks collapse between March, April, and May of this season, because that's just not fair to what's happening. They're a good team. They're a really good defensive team, despite that three-point shooting luck. Make no mistake, this is a good defensive team, and it's not surprising with Tom Thibodeau. That's a sustainable thing you can build around. Julius Randle's a sustainable piece that you can either use to build around or to move and get something back. I mean, this is where they are right now. They're building a foundation. The team across in Brooklyn was in a similar predicament a few years ago, and look what happened. You know, piece by piece, they got better. And then when the situation presented itself, they looked like a competent place to land for two incredible free agents. And then, oh, by the way, a trade demand came. And now the Nets look like a legitimate championship threat. The Knicks are like 3 or 4 years away from setting that up, potentially in Manhattan. And I think this is the kind of season that is a very good first step on that long journey.
I will say this, Royce, you know, they picked Emmanuel Quickley, maybe the 25th pick in the draft, 26th pick in the draft, I can't remember now. They picked him essentially because, I mean, they had inside intel to him because They had hired Kenny Payne as an assistant from Kentucky. Quickly was a highly touted recruit who didn't have a great year and sort of slid down the draft boards and has been a revelation. Has this really aggressive game. I got to say, this is the first time I've ever heard this. He idolizes Lou Williams,
mm-hmm.
which is, in a way, an amazing – that tells me so much about him, because Lou Williams is a guy who has carved out an incredible career in the NBA by learning what his role is. And for a certain class of player, modeling yourself after Lou Williams, I mean, I don't know if I want to do it defensively. And the man at one point, you know, had two girlfriends publicly that knew about each other. I'm sure some NBA players model, they like to model themselves after that. But it told me a lot about him, the way he sort of views what his career could be. I really liked that about him. But like that draft pick, that was a really good move. And by the way, it's another reason why, you know, some people I hear during trade season, you know, like right now I was talking to somebody about Philly, you know, making a trade the other day, and they're like, well, I talked about their first round draft pick maybe being available. I'm like, yeah, it might be the 27th pick. I'm like, Jimmy Butler was a 29th pick. You know, I mean, that's not nothing. And that's an example of even getting a second first round pick could mean so much. But that's definitely something that they can have traction going forward if they can draft like that.
Yeah. I mean, because that's been one of the big failures with the Knicks, is that when they've drafted high in the lottery, which has been often, or when they've just drafted at all, they have not really nailed those whatsoever. And, you know, the Knicks have not conditioned themselves to be an organically built team, right? Like, they're not like a draft and develop organization. They really never have been, at least in recent history. What they've tried to do is to use the prestige of their name, the market that they're in, and the aura around the organization, or at least the perceived aura, and use that as a free agent pitch to get rich quick, right? Like, that's what they wanted, is they wanted to wake up one morning and have $1 million in their bank account because some free agent was intoxicated by the New York Knicks and chose to sign there. And you can roll down the line of how many times they whiffed in those cases, and they have been left basically in just on a perpetual treadmill going nowhere. So what they've done now, and Kirk touched on it perfectly, is the Nets are kind of the example, as much as that might be a hard pill to swallow for the Knicks, but the Nets developed some organic young players, some of them that they have recycled. You know, D'Angelo Russell, I think, is a really good comparison for what Julius Randle is doing right now. And, you know, you kind of use a reclamation project to jumpstart your culture again, get you winning games, get kind of a developmental mindset going. And then you start to kind of build from the ground up, and the Knicks are going to look like a very compelling free agent destination, the one that they've always fancied themselves to be, pretty quickly. Because we keep using the word competent, that's like literally the bar is so low for them to clear. So
somebody's going to demand a trade. Somebody's going to demand a trade to New York.
And just say, I want to go there, because like you go there and you know, they're primed to kind of be put over the top. And we're talking about it. Like, I think that the Knicks organization, Knicks fans, like, define your level of success this year. Kirk said it. It is not necessarily about being a top four seed. I don't even know if it's really about making the playoffs. They just needed to reorganize themselves and start heading in a positive direction. Now, all that to be said, we touched on it. They're overstuffed at point guard. You mentioned quickly, Brian, I love that guy, and I'm really intrigued about him. But this is where you can kind of fall into that trap of where you're straddling the fence. You want to maintain your level of good right now because you're getting kind of intoxicated by it. But also, you can't lose sight of the long term. The Knicks are not winning the title this year. They're probably not winning a playoff series. You can look at all that's in front of them in the East. So, like, don't lose sight of the developmental mindset because you want to play Derrick Rose 33 minutes in a game. You got to get quickly minutes. You got to get top in minutes. You got to invest in those guys because that's going to be what pays off in the long run.
So here's the thing. They have one of the top former agents in the league running the organization in Leon Rose. They're number two in their team. I'm not sure what Wes Wesley's title is, but his specialty is relationship building with players. Even if it's waned a little bit as he's gotten older, his specialty is relationship building. And I don't want to say backroom dealing, because that implies that it's sinister, but he's known for working in the shadows. Okay. They play in New York City. They have an abundance of draft picks, young assets, and cap space. Okay. The only sort of flaw in here is I'm not sure that every player wants to play for Tibbs, but there are some who'd like him. I say within the next 12 months, a star slash superstar player demands a trade to New York. And I don't know who it's going to be. I have some guesses. I'm not going to say right here. I'll let you guys start thinking about that. Let's just put it this way. League executives certainly have some guesses. And I say by next year's trade deadline, a player, a superstar, you know, all-star player tries to force his way there. And they're going to be in position to do that type of trade. And maybe that's where Julius Randle comes in. He does his greatest service to the Knicks, especially if he continues to play this way, because he could be, you know, part of their of a trade centerpiece. But since they have cap space, cap flex, but they have everything that you need, they just don't have a good reputation. And that's getting worked on.
Vivid Seats wants you to get to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seat Rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code HOOP. That's code HOOP, H-O-O-P. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live. Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavily on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liquor, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
All right, speaking of teams where guys are forced trades to, I want to talk about the LA Clippers. They had a disappointing loss on Sunday. Now, by the time this podcast comes out on Tuesday morning, it'll be somewhat forgotten, but they blew another game late in Milwaukee. And I don't want to take anything away from Giannis. Giannis was terrific down the stretch of that game. He took it. It's the type of performance that you want from your MVP. Absolutely. And, you know, Milwaukee just went out on a road trip where they had some tough losses, and that was just a really good home win for them. But I want to call some attention to some stuff with the Clippers. Now, we've talked about on this podcast, it's been talked about other places. If you follow the Clippers at all, you know that they sometimes struggle in late game offense, that they, you know, they've used all of their trade assets on, you know, on getting Paul George and Kawhi Leonard. And then they used what they had left to get Marcus Morris. And then they used their free agency money on Serge Ibaka. So they've just sort of let their point guard position go a little bit. But there's some other things beyond point guard that I think I want to point out. And primarily is that they are flat out unacceptably poor in the clutch. And, you know, the stats that we can measure are a game within 5 points with inside 5 minutes to go. And I can't believe how bad they are. So overall, they are the number four offensive team in the league. So in a year of great offense, by the way, that means that they would be historically great. let me see where they're actually at right now. Right now, they're at 116.7 offensive rating. That would be number one of all time at the end of the season. Okay. So they're an awesome offensive team. In the clutch, they slide all the way down to 17, number 17. And by the way, that's improved. When I first looked at this stat about 10, 15 days ago, they were 30th. Okay. But it's not as simple as looking just at their offense, which is where we noticed them struggle to get into stuff, which definitely happened in the bubble last year. And Paul George is shooting shots off the backboard. Defensively, okay, overall, they're okay. They're 15th. Not great. Needs to be better, especially with the talent they have. Guys, defensively, they are 30th in the clutch. They can't stop anybody under the clutch, and they don't score very well. This is a big-time problem because this is what cost them last year. And this is, you know, some stuff you see in the regular season, and it's easy to say, you know, it's regular season. It's not that big of a deal. This, to me, is a big red flashing light with this team. And, you know, anybody who's listened to this podcast knows I was so high on them last year. I thought they were going to win even through their struggles. And the honeymoon is over for me. And I'm really worried about what's going to happen with them. And I'm not 100% sure what they can do to fix it.
Yeah, it's a red flag. And for some context, according to the NBA website, they played 38 minutes of clutch time so far, and the defense has been atrocious. It's relatively small. But here's the thing. Before we go throwing out this thing as a small sample, I think fairly, if you were going to come into this season and say, there's one thing I'm really concerned about with the LA Clippers, it's their ability to perform in intense situations, right? Because what we saw last year in the bubble was a collapse and players who just didn't look like they wanted to be there in some cases. And then when they were there, didn't look like they could perform. So to see especially their defensive collapses in crunch time, the Giannis dunk in that game, by the way, was one of the most ferocious highlight dunks in a highlight reel situation I've ever seen.
I'm not expecting them to shut that down.
Yeah, but it was just, as an aside, if you haven't seen it, everybody look it up. I think there was like 10 seconds left. There was a high leverage moment, and Giannis essentially made a dunk contest dunk to help seal the game. But again, that points to the Clippers' lack of defensive execution in a late game possession in a big game against a real opponent. I think in the context of where we came out of the bubble last year, these clutch numbers are particularly troubling because it's humming the same tune, essentially. Can the Clippers get it done in big moments? And the numbers right now say maybe not.
Yeah. You know, you talk about 30th. I mean, I'm when I looked that up, Brian, because you started talking about it, and I thought, okay, let's see where they're really at. And when I pulled those numbers up, and not only you see the 30 next to their name on the clutch time defense, but like when you see the actual points per 100 possessions that they're giving up, where it's 132.6, like not only are they 30th, I mean, the Hawks are kind of there with them, which is, you know, impressive company to be next to in terms of defense. They're 127.9, but 28 is 118.2. So like the Clippers aren't just the worst. They're like way the worst, like very much the worst in terms of clutch time defense, and their net rating in the clutch is a minus 25.9.
That's very bad.
I don't understand it. Is, you know, I don't even really know how to like analyze that and to try to diagnose like what the issue might be, because the design of that team that we all kind of understood to be was they have maybe the two premier wing defenders in the NBA. So like the way that they were supposed to win games, Brian, is that they stopped you. It wasn't, you know, we all kind of accepted that they may have some offensive issues late in games, you know, isolation and who gets the ball and who's taking turns. And, you know, do you lean on Lou Williams in those moments because he's such a good shot maker? And so we all kind of accepted that. But like we all saw the Clippers to be fine because they're going to stop you. They got Kawhi and PG, and you're going to have a hard time scoring on them. And they're just going to win games because they lock you down. Not only has that not happened, but that's not happened to such an insane degree that I can't comprehend what the issue is at this point.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they have defensive players on their roster. They may not be playing their high, you know, Kirk mentioned earlier that they've only played, you know, they've played 38 minutes or whatever of clutch defense. That's because they've won a lot of games where they've handled their business and not had to play in the clutch a lot.
But guess what? Playoff games are close, typically.
I seem to remember some close games in Orlando, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, I was on the Lakers last year a lot because I felt that they traded away so much for Anthony Davis, who had totally guided himself to L.A., that they were totally bidding against themselves and they just wildly overpaid. And that I thought it would hurt them going forward, adding to their team. And it limited what they could do last year. But guess what? Anthony Davis was so damn good in Orlando that it made it all worth it. And I've retired that argument and just admitted that it was worth it, because when you win, it means never having to say you're sorry. The Clippers have hemmed themselves in where they've given up so many assets. They do have a collection of second-round picks that they could use you know, in a trade, but they don't have a whole lot to trade. I mean, their tradable pieces are Lou Williams, who's on the last year of his contract. And it'll be very difficult, I think, for them to trade Lou for a player that would replace him, because he's pretty valuable to them driving their second unit. You know, they, you know, you take Zubac and, you know, I don't know, some of their other end of the bench guys, maybe you could do something there, but it's not a lot. And then Beverly, with his injuries and his inability to really shoot effectively, and his contract is a little bit outsized, you know, unless you're adding a premium to him, I don't think that you're going to be able to trade him for much value. And Luke Kennard is an interesting piece, but they when they traded for him, he had some injury concerns. Those injury concerns in his knee have re-popped up, and then they signed him to a huge extension, which maybe will end up looking okay, but I was stunned when they did it, but it certainly makes him harder to trade. Kirk, I just don't know how they functionally improve unless it's with the buyout market, unless there's a guy in the buyout market who says, I want to be a Clipper. And even then, I think it's a tight market.
It's a tight market. It always is. But there's always one or two difference makers in there, and maybe they get one of them. I haven't studied that yet to see who that could be. But, you know, Brian, one of your strongest points on the Clippers, and you didn't get into it this time yet, is like this is essentially a team that went all in on a two-year window. And we're now, update, 1.5 years into that two-year window. They've got a lot riding on this. This is a big experiment. As you mentioned, they mortgaged the future on this. Either it's not going to work and they're going to be left with very little future assets, or they're going to have to figure it out in these clutch time moments, in these big intense playoff moments. But the scariest thing about the Denver series last year to me was just like they didn't look like they had the fight of a champion.
That's true.
And for a team with
That's why they changed the coach at the end of the day.
Right? Yeah, they had to. They had to. And they got a championship coach now. And look, Kawhi Leonard, we've seen what he does in playoffs. He can turn it on.
And Kawhi has been more engaged this year. There's no doubt that they have attempted to keep the gas down from the start. And they've had some really good wins. I mean, they've had a lot going for them. I'm just saying this clutch stuff is... Whew.
But what happens if they don't do it this year? I think it's a fair question to ask based on everything they have out there. You know, if I'm not mistaken, Kawhi has an option at the end of this season.
You are not mistaken.
Is there a market for Kawhi Leonard out there?
There might be. There might be.
So I'm just saying. I'm not saying the player you were referencing.
Is that what? No, that was not.
Oh my God, aggregators. That was not the Knicks player.
Oh boy. Oh boy. Did I just ruin everything?
Oh, man.
Now, here's the thing, though. You know, when Kirk mentioned it about the future of the Clippers and what is riding on their current situation, you know, when you look at – and look, I completely – I think we all completely understand and respect the decisions the Clippers made in that summer, and I think that they – if they could reverse back, they would do it all over again, 100%. The Clippers organization should do that. 10 out of 10 times in my mind. Now, I think that we can reflect on that trade, and especially you see how good Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is, and to add in 5 first-round picks on top of that.
I don't think there's any regrets on that.
But, I mean, he's extremely good, and, you know, with the picks attached to it, that was a whole lot to give up. Now, sometimes we can sound silly when we talk about these intangible elements of a team, because we look at the statistics and the analytics and the data and all those things available to us. But, you know, when you talk about not having the fight, that's what I think concerns so many people, is that it's this kind of like, you know, tough guy thing to think about with the team, but like, where is the backbone of the Clippers? And if they're in another playoff series and they're down 3-2 in a series and they have to win game 6, like, do you believe in the Clippers? And I think I believe in the roster itself and the names on the roster. I would say those players can do that. I believe in Kawhi Leonard. But do you believe in the Clippers and that team to function and to rise up? And the thing is that until you do it, especially when you have a recent failure on your resume, I personally don't. I would not picture them winning an intense must-win game 6 when they had to do it, just because they don't have the equity in my mind to pull it off.
Let me split hairs there. Do I think at tip off with Kawhi and Paul George and Serge Ibaka and Ty Lue, do I think at tip off that they can win a series that's 2-2 you know, game five, that they can win that game, or 3-2 that they're down trying to force game seven? Yes, I do believe that they can. How do I feel, though, if it's a 4-point game with 2 minutes to play?
The numbers say you should feel pretty
bad. That's a different, you know, it's a different discussion. And you know, to be a championship team, you got to be able to do both. And nobody's going to win all of those situations, but their situation is problematic, to say the least. And I think it's, to be honest with you, I think it's really on Ty Lue. Certainly their front office has got to scour the market and scratch every surface and try to figure something out. And I'm sure they are, because they have a great front office, but it's also on Ty Lue to tighten those bolts. That's why he's there. He got that job to be able to do that. And he has done it. But I think some of that is on him to be able to figure out the lineups and the attacks and the defenses to do it. And to me, I think that's almost what the whole second half of the season is about for them. Regardless of what their seed is, regardless about what their record is, they've got to get to a place in their mind and spirit that when they get into a late game situation, that they feel confident, because they are a different team under those circumstances. And that is not changing. You definitely have seen a change in Kawhi's attitude. He's playing in back-to-backs. He's showing more leadership based on, you know, everything you hear. I mean, I'm not there. I haven't been in Los Angeles, sadly, for 51 weeks. I think I was in LA a year ago next week, maybe a year ago this week. I haven't been inside and around their team and talked to their guys enough, but from what I can tell and what I've been told, he's, you know, there's efforts being made on that end. Paul George is having a great season, has, you know, said things and is trying to back them up. I mean, all of that is true, but guys, it's got to show under the heat. And I'm not judging them by one Sunday afternoon in Milwaukee, but that was an example of what might be holding them back. Winning is an everyday mindset. And on the Ways to Win podcast, coaches Craig Robinson and John Calipari are here to help. Each week, Craig and Coach Cal use their on-court wisdom to solve your off-court problems. Whether it's trouble at home or a workplace dilemma, the coaches will help you find a winning formula for success. And you'll hear from prominent athletes, business leaders, and celebrities who reveal insights that made them into the leaders they are today. Like President Obama, who breaks down his bracket and talks about how he deals with pressure by projecting confidence, believing in your team, and taking criticism. Listen to Ways to Win wherever you get your podcasts. You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes, catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So who's ever up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, girl-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit directtv.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Stephen A's World streams weekdays on ESPN Plus, bringing fans Stephen A. Smith's entertaining perspective and deep expertise with some signature guests. The best interviews from Stephen A's World are now available as a podcast every Wednesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts and watch Stephen A's World on ESPN Plus. All right, before we go, I wanted to touch on one more thing. Woj had a report Sunday about Victor Oladipo turning down a contract extension with the Rockets. To me, guys, this is really just sort of a pro forma cap tip to just let everybody know he's going to be traded, or they're going to try like hell to trade him. It's not so much that I think it was 2 years, $45 million or whatever. They offered it to him because I think you have to do that. They didn't expect him to take that, and he wouldn't be expected to sign it. He's not having a great year. He hasn't been great since he came back from his terrible knee surgery. But the reason that they offer that and that he turns it down is to sort of, you know, a little palate cleanser before trading him, because they don't want to make it seem like they weren't interested in him or there's something wrong with him. I mean, guys, he's only shooting 38 or 39% overall since the trade, shooting 29% from three. He's had some moments, and he's been banged up again. So let me ask you this: Royce, what do you think happens with, I mean, I think it's almost a certainty he's going to get traded, or at least very hardly traded. What do you think happens with Oladipo at this point?
Well, let me ask this first though, Brian, like, cause I saw the consensus was of like, yeah, he wasn't going to take that. Like why wouldn't he at least consider that? I know that it's 2 years is a short-term deal in the NBA, but where's Victor Oladipo's market going to make more than $22.5 million a year? Am I missing something? I mean, we're talking about a player that came back from a severe injury. When he came back last year, did not play well, looked extremely rusty, struggled finishing at the rim, struggled getting his shot off. Then he had the bubble saga of whether he was going to play or not, did not play well in the bubble. He had some decent moments, I think, to start the year in Indiana this year, kind of seemed to maybe be regaining some of his form. But then you just laid it out. He has for basically a month straight, did not play well at all. I don't know. I mean, if I'm Victor Oladipo, I'm sitting there going, is my market going to be better than that? I understand the logic of, you know, the Rockets making the offer for optics, but I don't know that to me, that wouldn't have been just a straightforward turn down by Oladipo. I don't know what his trade market would be for the same exact reason. What kind of asset would you give up to get Victor Oladipo? I assume that most people would believe he's worth a first round pick.
Well, I think Victor Oladipo is a good enough player that one of the 30 teams will talk themselves into giving him some money. Yeah,
there's going to be right now. Let's see how things go. There's going to be 10 teams with 20 plus million in space. There's not going to be 10 players worth getting that. So I think it's a reasonable gamble for Victor that he can find a contract that's at least equal to that. And let me just say that even if he, for some reason, doesn't and gets a little bit less, it's worth the gamble for him, I think, to go into free agency.
And there's the other thing that I wanted to bring up, and Royce did a really good job of highlighting it. But maybe he just doesn't want to play in Houston. You know, that's a situation that rubs a lot of players the wrong way, right or wrong. But, you know, he doesn't want to be there. They've lost 10 in a row. Why would I want to just sign up for two more years? There's going to be some market for me. Why do I have to commit to the Houston Rockets right now in the middle of this terrible stretch of basketball? Somebody out there is going to look at his numbers those first 2 years in Indiana when he's an all-star, scoring 20-plus at an efficient rate, a really athletic player, and say, yeah, he's still only 28, 29 years old. I think there's more tread left on the tires here. This guy can be a really good player again. So I think it's a fair gamble. It's a gamble, but it's a fair gamble, Royce, to your point. And I expect to see him starting for a different team somewhere maybe next year.
So I think at this point, to be honest with you, I think there's kind of two different scenarios. There's teams who may not be able to sign Oladipo next summer, and so maybe they try to get him now. But then there's also just the straight rental market. Is there a team out there who's like, all right, Victor Oladipo is highly incentivized to play well. We really could use a player to boost us in the second half. This is a high level rental. So what are the teams that would really make sense for a rental? And I have two and a half that come to mind.
I have Miami at the top of my
list. Miami was the very first team I thought of, for sure.
Okay, so they're kind of, you know, for sure, they, you know, Victor wants to play there. The Boston needs more of a forward. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I mean, look, Boston needs firepower, so I'm not saying no, but, I think, you know, and Miami has some, you know, they have some contract ballast, you know, they gave Myers Leonard a $9 million contract essentially to use him in a trade. So I don't know what the price of Miami would be. And the other thing is Miami, you know, Victor, I don't think it's any secret in the league. Victor has a desire to play in Miami. He'd like to go there in free agency. They're going to have cap space. So that may happen. And, you know, Miami may say, well, why would we trade a good piece for him? Like, you know, let's just say hypothetically, everybody hear that? Hypothetically, let's say like Houston said, well, you know, we'll trade you, but you got to include Kendrick Nunn in the package or something like that. And, you know, they may say, well, listen, we can just sign Oladipo next summer and keep Kendrick Nunn too. Why would we do both? You know, but Miami for sure. Another team is the Knicks, you know, the Knicks are a team that, you know, they have all that open cap space. It's an easy trade for them to make. They have extra picks. You know, the Knicks have two first round picks, theirs and Dallas's, and they have, I think they have Detroit's second round pick, which right now would be in the low 30s. So they have some attractive pieces and that cap space. You know, they have some attractive pieces to go hunting if they want. And then sort of the more interesting team potentially, you know, I don't know if how interested, I don't know how much it helps them, but would maybe be Dallas. Maybe be just, you know, Dallas needs something to spice them up. I'm not sure what Victor, you know, Dallas needs defense, and I'm not sure where Victor is defensively right now, but I mean, those are three teams that come to the front of my head. I sort of count Miami as the half team because I'm not sure they trade for him when they could sign him. But
one that jumps off the page to me, Brian, is Denver. I feel like Denver is in need of a trade. I think that they're in need of firepower. They've desperately needed wing help for 2 years now. I know that they all like Facundo Campazzo and he's fun to watch, but like I don't know how much Mike Malone wants to play him like extended minutes in a playoff series. Especially, you know, I just think that that's a team, and they've got young guys that they probably would be somewhat willing to part with to make a deal happen.
Gary Harris has been involved in trade talks to a handful of teams in the last 6 to 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
He's just really struggled for the last year and a half, and I just don't think his value is that high. And he's got money left on the deal.
Would you give up RJ Hampton though to take your shot with Oladipo?
You know, I mean, if that's maybe Houston thinks about that, yeah, maybe Bol Bol, maybe Hampton and Bol Bol. I don't know.
They've got young players that I think could at least compel like the Rockets to like take their offer. Now the Nuggets might very clearly be looking at it as a pure rental, like that might. But they're in that window phase, right? Like they went to the Western Conference Finals. They've been disappointing to start this year. There's a little bit of pressure building on them, and like they're reaching that point where okay, you're in the window. So like take your steps forward. I could just see them being a player at the trade deadline. Maybe not for Oladipo, but for somebody.
Yeah, it's not a bad call. You know, I don't know how active this trade deadline is going to be, Kirk, because we've got a whole bunch of teams in the mix. You know, a player like Oladipo could end up being one of the top. I mean, heck, depending on what happens with Kyle Lowry in Toronto, I still don't know what's going to happen in Toronto. I don't have any sense that they're going to trade him. But if Kyle Lowry is not available in Toronto, Oladipo might be the number one name on the market.
Yeah, I could see that for sure. He's a heck of a player, and you can see him in making big plays in playoff games, and anybody wants that. And the other thing is, we talked about how bunched up the East is. The West is kind of bunched up in its own way too. Like a player like Oladipo could get you over the hump in some cases, get you to a round that you might not have gotten to otherwise mm-hmm. in the playoffs this year. I'm not mad at the idea that he's the best guy on the trade market. Kyle Lowry, I just can't imagine them doing that. But people are talking about it. But both Victor Oladipo, you know, to a team like Miami or a team like Denver, as Roy suggests, that's a game changer for one of these teams.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on it for sure. All right, thank you, Royce. Thank you, Kirk. Thank you to Dan, spinning the controls back in Connecticut. And I just want to, before we go, give a shout out to Troy Farkas, who's been our producer for the last couple of years. Troy left us to go to Greener Pastures. I want to thank Troy for everything that he did, recording in the middle of the night at sometimes, all kinds of things during the pandemic, late after the bubble games. So thank you and good luck to Troy. Thank you for listening to the Hoop Collective. Have a great week, everybody. We'll talk to you later.